The time is 1:45. The day is March the 7th. Before us today is three bills, Senate Bill 218, House Bill 485, and House Bill 408. So we'll go ahead and start with Senate Bill 218. But before we do, I want to welcome Representative Moses, Representative Kelly, Co-Chairman Chenault, myself, Co-Chairman Meyer, Vice Chairman Stoltz, Representative Stula, Representative Hawker, the members present.
Who's this gratuitous person?
Okay, let's go ahead and go right into Senate Bill 218. If Senator Bundy wants
to join us. You want a motion to move the bill?
No.
Okay.
See, Representative Newman. There's Representative Newman. I don't know if Senator Guess was coming or not. If she does, she can join us too. Okay. Also, welcome Representative Jewell. And let's see, where did we leave off here?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
If I might just, as you open, thank you again for the committee for their time. And just to put another finer point on things, over the weekend there was charitable reports about a fellow who got a 14 or 15 year old girl drunk and had sex with a girl. And just yesterday in the proving it doesn't all happen today, in the daily news writer, a fellow was arraigned Friday on charges that he raped a woman Thursday night, hours after he had been released from the correctional center. Obviously, he is one of those that would benefit from a longer sentence. That was Chairman Owens, but you returned your delivery.
All right. That kind of leads us into a motion here to get a CS before us. I need a motion to adopt the Blight Committee substitute for SB 218 version 24LS1301307/U-CARP dated 3606 as a working document. Do I have a motion to do that?
I'll make that motion, Mr. Chairman.
Any objections? Seeing none, then we have that CS before us. Senator Bundy?
Mr. Chairman, I think I'd like to ask Department of Law to go through the CS author or chat with Director Newman.
That's fine. Yeah, Susan.
Okay, we do have both, obviously, Susan Parks, Deputy Attorney General, and we have Portia Parker here for questions. Susan?
Thank you for the record. My name is Susan Parks, Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division. And just to highlight the changes in the CS, there are three main changes. A main change in Section 1 and Section 2, and for those kind of a peer group amendment. As we went through the committee process and discussed concerns about the bill, one of the concerns that came up repeatedly was making sex offenders out of the 18-year-old who was having sex with the 15-year-old. Often we found those were people who were in high school together.
Ms. Parks, if we may, I hate to interrupt, but let's pull the table out so you have more room, and then also invite Senator Guest to join you. Okay, for the record, Senator Guest is also, who's also co-sponsored the bill, has joined us. I'm sorry, Ms. Parks, please.
Certainly. So, in trying to address the concerns about sort of peer groups and whether it actually should be criminal, whether you did not intend to encourage it or approve of it, but certainly whether that should be criminal conduct that would require someone registering as a sex offender. In light of that, Section 1 and Section 2 now makes basically sex between teenagers 13 and older only criminal if the one is 17 years or older and there's 4 years age difference between the two parties. The other major change to the CS is in Section 8, which is on page 7. The original bill mandated that there be probation for sex offenses. Well, probation only has teeth if there's suspended time required, so that if someone violates probation, there's an ability to punish them. And so Section 8 now mandates that there be suspended time, so that every sex offender, unless they're getting a mandatory 99 years, this would require a certain amount of suspended time. That mandatory probation actually has some teeth in it. Because of requiring the suspended time, there were some amendments also to the ranges within here. If you go through them, many of the ranges were up by 5 years to allow for the suspended time that's required. And finally, there was one other change from the original bill, and that is on page 6, line 11. The original bill had a range for C felony, first felony conviction, 3 to 12 years. That got changed from 1 to 12 years in a prior committee. CS now took the middle ground and makes the range 3 to 12 years. I believe those are the changes in the process.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Ms. Parks. Also, for the record, we do have Quinlan Steiner, the Office of the Public Defender, online for questions. Okay, any questions, Ms. Parks, on the CS itself? Senator Stoltz?
Just, Mr. Chairman, just generally on the sentencing, watching the news last night about a Valley sentencing proceeding on an unrelated case, I think it was an arson murder case, reminded me of the truth in sentencing provisions where they, can you tell, what are the provisions that when we're talking 99 and 35 and what are the actual maximum times that they serve or the minimum?
Representative Stoltz through the chair, I'd have to go back and look. One important thing when you're dealing with sex offenses, and if you get a mandatory 99, what you've lost your good time because of a prior bill and the statutory.
Okay.
If you have a prior sex offense, you're not going to get good time. So that isn't going to be a part of that. But for example, first felony offender who gets 6 years to serve, you can get a third off for good time, so you're really looking at 4 years. And I think there's also discretionary probation that could get you out even a little bit earlier.
It's true. I was only bringing that up as I recall just watching on the news last night. The gentleman from Wasilla got 99 years, and in the clip, the end clip, of course, he's eligible for parole in 23 and a half years. And just wanted that some of these, I wasn't aware of the good time provision. Some of these aren't as severe as we ultimately like them to be once the process works.
Okay, any other questions pertaining to the CS itself? Okay, seeing none, I want to welcome Representative Palmer and Representative Kelly to the committee. If there's no other questions pertaining to the CS, hopefully you all have copies of the proposed amendments. Okay, we'll start with Amendment 1, which is this one, Mike?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I'll move Amendment 1.
I'll object.
Okay. Let's see, why am I making this amendment? Do you have Ms. Parks?
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. I knew it was good. I just didn't know what it did.
Mr. Chair, this is an amendment to Section 3, or what used to be Section 3 of the original bill, which is now. Yes, Section 3. This is the failure to report sex offender development act. There were concerns raised by the Public Defender Agency and OPA that even as written in the bill as it stands now, it creates an ethical dilemma for the defense attorney who is trying to represent someone who should be registered and hasn't registered, and they're trying to give them legal advice. The language in Amendment 1 is language that I worked out with Mr. Steiner, the public defender, Mr. Quinlan of OPA. This is language the three of us were able to come to an agreement on, and that they believe will mitigate or militate their ethical issue, and it's also not that I believe we can still adequately prosecute some of these crimes.
Okay, very good. Mr. Steiner, are you indeed online?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. This is Quinlan Steiner with the Public Defender Agency.
Okay, and so you're aware of Amendment 1, is my understanding?
I haven't seen the amendment in the paperwork, but I did work with Ms. Parks to develop some language that we believe should fix the ethical dilemma.
Okay. Very good. Okay, any, do you still maintain your objection?
No, sir. Okay. Chairman, if staff can make sure that Mr. Steiner has all these amendments up north or wherever he is.
Okay.
If he doesn't have them, fair playing field.
Sure. Mr. Steiner, we'll be faxing you the amendments that will be being brought forward here.
Great, thank you.
Okay. Okay, so Amendment 1 passes. Going on now to Amendment 2.
Mr. Chairman, I withdraw Amendments 2 and 3.
Okay.
Go straight to 4.
All right. Amendment 4. Okay. All right, Representative Couture, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Amendment number 4.
Object.
Okay.
Before I begin with the amendments, and first I want to apologize for the number of them. They don't reflect my deep respect and sincere appreciation to the sponsors and their staff for bringing forward important legislation. It's complicated legislation, and we were working off the CS from last night, so that's why the number and somewhat confusion with having to withdraw the first two amendments. I also want to thank the sponsors for removing and changing the crime of omission and for extending statutory rape a year, because I think that's a really critical point, and I would have brought an amendment to that, and instead the sponsors changed it, so I want to thank them for that. Amendment number 4 are the sentences for unclassified Class A and Class B felonies. They're undeniably serious crimes, and they should carry serious penalties. But in the last few years, we've seen increases in these penalties, both by the Blakely decision, by Senator French's bill, and I think that, you know, for the committee's consideration, if we start to increase the sentences up as high as this, we're going to have to look at the commensurate costs. So Amendments 4 and Amendment 5, which follows, which is the lesser crime, are efforts to simply bring down the sentences into a realm where I think that we could ease our way in and find out what the true ramifications of raising sentences will be like. So that's the reason for Amendment 4. And again, that's only unclassified Class A and Class B, which are the more serious felonies.
Okay, very good. You wanted to reduce the fiscal note. Is that why you're bringing this forward?
Yeah, indiscriminate fiscal note. No, it's not just the fiscal note.
I understand. Okay. Okay. Any of the sponsors want to comment?
I'll lead off by saying, Mr. Chairman, Senator Couture brings up a good point. This bill will cost money. And we as a policy-making group have to worry about budgets, and then we also have to worry about quality of our society. And there are, I think, cases when we have to acknowledge that to have a safe society, that there are some financial costs involved. The other thing I'd like to mention is what large sentences do. They put people in jail for a long time and cost money. They also send a very clear signal as to what our standards are as a society. And for rational, thoughtful people, they'll say the price is too high in the size of the sentence to perhaps be tempted to engage in some of the behaviors that they're trying to do. So while there is a financial cost, there is also a societal cost to have these people back out on the streets again and to not send a very clear message that this is just the most heinous kinds of crimes and society is saying, no, no more, we're not going to tolerate this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to, again, the cost is going to come up and it's going to be an issue, I mean. This specific amendment looks at, we're talking to kids less than 13 years of age, you know, and where do you draw the line? But I think we also look at the cost of, what it costs to rehabilitate these folks for the rest of their lives. This is a sentence, this is a sentence that these victims have to carry for their whole life. And we have presented some information earlier that talks to that cost. I don't remember those offhand, but I believe it was around $45,000 a person on an average. We've got 518 reported victims, and only 16% of the cases will report. By trying to reduce some of these costs through reducing the rates, we also have to remember the rate of recidivism on this. It's the folks here just, they don't get rehabilitated, and that's the bottom line. We can look at a lot of these different amendments that lower a lot of costs. I think the same argument holds true on every one. Where in society do we want to do this? I think we also have to remember the costs, as I stated earlier, with discussions that I've had with Commissioner Kandetsky. And again, the question that I had with Commissioner Kandetsky was, do folks that commit these types of crimes, are they likely to commit other types of crimes? And the answer to that was yes, on an average of 11.75 other types of crimes that are committed by these sexual molesters. So they're not just committing these crimes, they're committing other crimes in society. These are the folks that are breaking into your house, stealing your merchandise, that you would feel, and other kinds of society. They're just, I don't want to tolerate anymore. You know, I think they need to, again, send a strong message that we're not going to do that. And look at the price tag that's attached to all these other types of crimes that are committed by these sexual molesters. And think of that as a whole, as a big picture, and how this is all involved.
Senator Guest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll address a couple of comments that the sponsor made. I speak against this amendment. I do appreciate her giving us a heads up and at least talking to us about this issue, which has been the case in other communities. Two things regarding her presentation. And it's Wakely and College of French and Bill. When we passed Wakely last year, and this has come up a lot, it was the testimony consistently by the administration that it didn't have anything to do with sentencing, it had to do with complying with the court case. And I think it's really important that we didn't sit down and ponder on any of the sentences for any of the crimes, what should be the appropriate range. I mean, purposely, that bill was actually passed fairly early on in the session, if folks remember. I mean, because I was on FedVest at the time, and I wasn't here. And so I don't want to confuse that with the fact that we as the legislature sat down and actually had an intellectual and policy discussion about what the range should be, and I don't think that's what the representative meant to say. On Senator French's bill, it does not, in fact, first time, and it was not something that actually went to the sentencing structure, but that no good time would be allowed for sex offenders. Sex offenders do very well in jail, and they get off in good time, most of the time. It's a very structured environment. And that's what he was trying to clamp down on. It wasn't, again, to what do we think the appropriate sentences are for these crimes. The third point I'd like to make is the changes in the third page of the amendment reduces the probationary section, which I strongly disagree with the entire amendment, but being able to have these folks on probation allows us to use the best practices of the polygraph allowing us to use the polygraph system in certain cases allows us to help people not use them. And so I just think it's wrong on a policy way to reduce the sentences, and it's wrong to reduce the probation for that reason. And I would agree with Representative Newman. The cost to sex crimes to society is a huge one, and I think a very unknown one, especially if you see the impact on victims and what happens with their behavior, especially with young people who are sexually assaulted. So although it might decrease the cost to corrections, I don't think it decreases the cost to society as a whole. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Guest. Any other comments on the amendment?
Amendment 4,
do you still...
The objection is maintained.
Maintain your objection.
I do, if I can say one quick thing. I apologize for not explaining the probation. And I think that the sponsors were right to include probationary periods in the bill, in the CS. That was new in the CS, and I felt that to be commensurate with the sentence, you had to work with the probation. So I like the addition of the probation. I agree with that. It was simply an effort to be able to bring the sentencing range down into a realm where significantly more than is current law, but not as high as the sponsors have it, which in some cases is indeed almost 10 times as high as we currently have. So that was the effort. This one, frankly, I think that this is the most difficult of all of the amendments, and that they'll get easier from here in. And this is the example I wanted to lead with. But having said that, I'm not going to, we're continuing with the amendment, so that's fine. Thank you. That was not my plan, but I'll be happy to continue with this amendment. The others, I would definitely continue with. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Petula. And before we vote on that, Senator Guest, you made a statement there that sex offenders do good in jail. Is that because they're segregated? Is that because they're just locked up? Or was there something to your do well in jail?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, it's been the testimony on past sexual offender bills in the Senate judiciary that the structured environment actually results in very good behavior, that it's it's just a different type of criminal. And when we were dealing with Senator French's bill, one of the reasons that there was the supporting documents was just discussion that sex offenders often get good time, which under this amendment for a rape would be 8 years. And so I was just going back to testimony in Senate judiciary on Senator French's bill, not being able to.
And Ms. Chairman, sex offenders generally look for vulnerable victims when they get in jail. They don't find any people who are more vulnerable than they are.
Thank you, Senator Bundy. With that, Madam Secretary, roll call on Amendment 4.
Representative Moses?
Yes.
Representative Stokes?
No.
Representative Hawker?
No.
Representative Holm? No. Representative Jewell? No. Representative Kelly? No. Representative Petula? Yes.
Representative Meyer? Nope. Representative
Chanel?
No.
Okay, so amendment
fails.
On amendment number 5.
I'm with amendment
number 5. Okay, sir.
Okay. Move to Objection 2, go ahead.
These are the sentences only for Class C felonies. This is the lowest class felony. While there certainly can be some serious behavior, it's often the least of the serious behavior and can include, as we talked somewhat about in the first hearing on this bill, it can include touching. Having the sentencing structure pop up to such a high level, and especially in light of the rest of the bill with the higher class felonies, in some cases to be the same in terms of especially the maximum, I think is really disproportionate to the crimes that we're dealing with. And for that reason, I balked with the amendment, which again also does include bringing commensurately down the probationary period, because I think otherwise it would be logical, so would be illogical rather. That's the amendment. Again, I appreciate the probationary idea. I think that's really valid. But to be logical within the structure of the amendment, I thought it had to bring that down as well. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Petula. Representative Stoltz, did you...
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I heard a reference to the incidental touching or something. I heard that more theatrical expression in the Judiciary Committee about that. I guess almost a courtroom drama. I've tried to get a handle on it and how often those types of offenses that were described are prosecuted, and was that a real issue we're dealing with? And if I can get maybe our criminal prosecutor expert there to comment on that.
Representative Stoltz, through the chair, I'd appreciate an opportunity to speak to the touching offenses, and I actually came prepared with some case examples, if the committee would indulge me, that I'd like to share so that you can actually get the idea of what kind of cases are being charged. First, I did do some research to find out how often are we charging standalone sorts of touching offenses, and what I found is it's extremely rare. In 2004, in 101 cases where we charged a touching offense, only 40 times was it the most serious charge. Normally it was charged with other charges or more serious charges. When these are charged, touching offenses are charged usually with a more serious charge, as I indicated. For example, we have a case out of Anchorage where we've charged touching offenses in a case, just to give you a case example, where a little girl starting at age 6, her father would come in nightly and touch her in her bedroom. This went on until she turned 14, when apparently he decided it was okay that he could then go on to penetration, and he began penetrating her on a nightly basis until she was 16 and it got reported. That's a case pretty typical where touching offenses become grooming offenses for the more serious conduct. Touching offenses are also charged when an attacker gets interrupted or gets fought off, and that's pretty typical. We can assume that they started to do something more or would have done something more, but they're interrupted or scared off. We had a case like that out of the Bethel area, where a young woman was gotten back into the back of a church, where this 20-year-old, held her up against the wall, started fondling her over her clothing, her breasts, her vagina, and it wasn't until the priest sort of interrupted them, he ran off, that she then got away. That was just a touching case. I had a case out of Kenai, where a woman was in bed with her husband, naked in bed with her husband, wakes up, and there's a man in her bedroom touching her in her bed, her husband asleep next to her. Here's another example of a case where a burglary is charged with a touching offense. So that's the kind of range of cases that you can find of touching. There's actually one more I wanted to share with you where all we had was touching, and this was a 14-year-old who was asleep in her bed when the neighbor who was over visiting snuck in, started touching her. She wanted him to leave her alone. He finally climbed on top of her, took off his clothes, and basically used a vernacular, dry humped her until he had finished. That was just a touching case. So that's the kind of cases we're charging under these offenses.
So, Representative, Mr. Chairman, so it's not the kind of I guess in other committees it's been described as the barroom grope on a passing by, and is that kind of that type of offense often or ever prosecuted?
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz.
On its own, I mean. It's,
yeah, when I surveyed my attorneys to try to get examples of cases, and these are real life examples, they said to me, And I asked about that. I could hear them laughing through the email. We don't charge those kind of cases. Juries don't convict on those kind of cases. The kind of cases I'm giving you aren't the most serious that came to me, but I think they sort of give you the wide variety of cases that can fall under this touching kind of thing.
And Mr. Chairman, I'd like to apologize for using some of the language we might use in an Elks poker game. You know, it's often hard to get there efficiently, and I apologize for that.
Okay, very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd also like to speak to the topic page where it asked to delete May 9th, slide 2 of the amendment. To point out that just prior to that, it is not May 9th. So it's not a definitive term there. So it would be not more than 99, so not more than 20. Also, at the bottom of page 1, delete 99, insert 9 to 20. Lines 22, 23. This is a third felony conviction. Two prior convictions. Obviously, you know, the recidivism rate again is not there. This person's not going to learn. This person does need to go away for a long, long time. And I just want to point those out to the committee.
Okay, thank you. I think it's safe to say all three of you are opposed to the amendment. Is that correct? I don't want to put words in just to expedite the process here. Senator, yes, did you have a comment?
Briefly, yes, I am opposed to the amendment. The reason for the large range, which I know is unusual, was twofold, and I did want to explain that to the committee.
Sure.
Especially at the third degree level, there are a wide variety, unfortunately, of conduct, but it includes sexual contact on people that are mentally incapable and incapacitated. It includes sexual penetration in the state correctional facilities. If anyone was listening to the NPR in the last week, there's been a recent study out at the problem of rape in the prisons. It wasn't specifically in Alaska, but nationwide. It also includes incest. So unfortunately, although it might do some of the minor things that have been discussed in other committees, although I don't see any of these as minor, there's also some serious crimes. And so the reason for such a wide range at this level was to try to give the courts some flexibility on these crimes. Because if you actually look at the aggravator section, aggravators and sex crimes actually don't mesh very well. And so I just want to explain to the committee why it was such a wide range on the first accounts.
Okay, very good. Anything else, Representative Petula?
Just quickly in closing, I appreciate the idea of flexibility. However, the range is one of the hard parts of this bill for me. And some of the examples that are given, you know, I think should probably be charged as a higher crime. That's what I struggle with here. How do we break this apart? We talked about it in the first meeting. I wish we've all, I think, tried to come up with language to carve out it's so hard to talk about because all of these are bad offenses. I'm not minimizing here. But how could you carve out the truly lesser, you know, not even be able to bring up these offensive examples, which weaken the case, but I find very offensive as well, to be able to recognize then that there are things that should be truly punished more that are going to maybe fall into this, while there are things that just shouldn't be part of it. It's just a really difficult road. So that's why. The second thing is that, unfortunately, a lot of flexibility does come the fact that you're turning a lot of this over to the courts then, that we're not doing the hard work ourselves, although it is very hard. So I understand it didn't happen. But it is to try to bring that out live. I guess one last point. When you're talking about three offenses, three felonies, it certainly sounds very bad, very onerous. But within that is included things like low-level thefts, things that I think all of us would not expect to see such a harsh, harsh final sentence on. So that's the difficulty about dealing with the C sentences. I broke them out from the other two just as, you know, so the committee can understand that even for these lower levels, we're bumping the sentences up very high. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Richard Cadula. Any other comments on amendment number 5? Okay, see none. Madam Secretary, could you please call the roll?
Representative Stoltz?
No.
Representative Walker?
No, ma'am.
Representative Holm?
No.
Representative Jewell?
No.
Representative Kelly?
No.
Representative Cretula?
Yes.
Representative Moses?
Yes.
Representative Chenault?
No.
And Representative Meyer?
No.
Okay.
Amendment 5 fails. Amendment 6, Representative Cretula.
Thank you. I move Amendment number 6.
I object, sir.
Go ahead.
This amendment was aimed to deal with the problem that the bill currently has, and there's discussion over this, but in my life previously as a defense attorney, I dealt with many people that I believe would know sentencing ranges and would unfortunately take them to heart. And what I was trying to avoid here, and I haven't quite done it because I left one of the sentences still higher than the lower sentences for murder 2. So my deep concern and the reason I'm bringing this amendment is that you may have a situation where knowing the sentences, someone might kill a person rather than leaving them alive because they could think that they were going to get a lower sentence because their sentences for murder 2 are lower. That begs the question of possibly raising the sentence for murder 2 or if there were a sex act involved, and we can certainly deal with that in later bills, and that may be very appropriate if we're going to do what the bill suggests. But for now, with the bill in front of us, I felt like that was just a dangerous enough situation that I wanted to bring it forward to the committee so that the committee heard that, and the amendment was within the structures I could deal with and the time I could deal with, the best I could do in terms of trying to address that concern. Thank you.
Okay. Very good. Thank you, Representative Cadula. Again, sponsors, I'm assuming you don't favor this. Okay. Okay. Any questions for the sponsors or for the maker of the amendment?
I'll just make a quick expression of my objection, sir.
Go ahead, yes.
Well, it's certainly a compelling argument constructed by the maker of the amendment. And truly it sounds callous, but with all respect, dead is dead. What a victim of these particular assaults, it is a life sentence. So I think there is a justification for the level of sentencing in the bill as presented to us, sir, and I would strongly maintain my objection.
Okay, very good. Representative Newman?
Again, thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, Representative Parker pointed out the majority of the amendments addressed on Amendment number 6 apply to victims less than 13 years of age. Also, they apply to people who are perpetrating serious crimes with the use of a firearm and a dangerous instrument. And I think that we need to send strong messages that, again, with the use of firearms, which to me is just additional force added on the person. And if that makes more egregious, so it is worth the more, the harsher sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bender.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we frequently hear about the aggravators, but I don't want the committee to forget there are mitigators. And in all these sentences, if there's a single mitigator, the sentence can be reduced as much as half. So we gotta continue to have some faith in our judicial system that there will be prosecutorial discretion, and then courts and juries will also have a reasonable view as we go through the process. I know this would not be the bill sponsor's intent, but there's something else I'd like to mention for many. I know, as a last thing, we don't care much how they do it outside, but there are a number of states that are substantially increasing the penalties for these sexual predators. And I would point out that sexual predators are quite a mobile group of people. They often don't have the family ties and commitments that many of us do. And I hate to see Alaska as good hunting grounds for sexual predators because our sentences were lower than their home state.
Okay, very good. Anything else from Senator Couture?
Oh, just very quickly, I was trying to be very careful and not get into the ranges after the first offense here. I was also pretty particular about bringing it, tried to be at least, to bring it just to the lower end of the offense, so that it would be that the lower end of the sentence would be less than the murder to be beginning sentence. And that, so I was not trying to do it across the board, wasn't trying to do it with second or third offenses. I was trying to do it with that first offense where I think that people tend to get a little bit excited. They haven't been heard or they haven't been in the system. And I just think that psychology is important to point it out. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman.
Sir,
it's time. Just at a point of research has shown that by the time someone is arrested and tried, they have many offenses behind them. This is just the first one that they tried.
Okay, good point. All right, Madam Secretary, if you could please read the roll.
Representative Hoffer?
No, ma'am.
Representative Holmes?
No, ma'am.
Representative Jewell?
No.
Representative Kelly?
No.
Representative Kutula?
Yes.
Representative Moses?
No.
Representative Stoltz?
No.
Representative Meyer?
No.
Representative Chanel?
No.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I am committee to chair, and if I could leave my able co-sponsors in charge, I would then know that I am just for the record opposed to any additional amendment.
Okay, very good. Appreciate that. Senator Bennett, thank you for joining us. I think you are in good hands here with the other co-sponsors. Thank you. Okay, amendment number 7, Representative Couture.
I move amendment number 7.
I'll object for discussion purposes.
Representative Couture.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is the amendment that deals with the failure to report a sex offender or a child kidnapper. And I believe that, if I can turn to the page, you've already amended and part of that to deal, this is page 3 of the instruction, part of that to deal with the omission for defense attorneys because you've run into the ethical considerations there. But the hard part to deal with at this point is I think that if someone knows and doesn't report, if someone, you know, truly understands the situation and knowingly or intentionally fails to report, then I absolutely feel like that's the offense, and that's right. But the standard that we've included right now is that you're recklessly disregarding that the person hasn't complied, hasn't registered, hasn't met up to the requirements. And that's where I start to get confused, and I'm afraid it will be confusing for people. And that's why I'm asking, the only change here is to reduce, or rather, require knowingly instead of recklessly, changing the intent of the person who doesn't report. Ms. Parks and I had a good conversation this morning, and she pointed out that there are crimes that use these dual standards between recklessly and knowingly, as the bill does. But I feel that it would be cleaner, it would make it easier to prosecute, and it would be easier for people who then, you know, actually know they're not reporting rather than just disregarding that they might not know something, but maybe they should do something. I just think the standard in the bill is just a little bit hard to understand. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Couture. Any comments from committee members? I'm assuming you guys, sponsors, are opposed.
Mr. Chair, yes, this was a section that came from my bill in the Senate, and I'm the post amendment. I think that having the recklessly and the knowingly is an appropriate standard, and the standard that we can prosecute. And I've asked Mr. Parks if he wants to put a comment on having recklessly in one section and knowingly on the other and prosecute.
Ms. Parks?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With all due respect, I don't believe it would make it easier to prosecute. I think it would make it much more difficult to prosecute these cases if you change the mental state to knowingly from recklessly, and we do have certain offenses that have both recklessly and knowingly. For example, sex offenses. You have to recklessly disregard that someone's not consenting, and then you knowingly do the conduct that constitutes the offense. We don't require people to knowing they don't consent, because that's a really difficult standard to meet. And so what recklessly requires is a pretty high standard. It requires that the person is aware of and consciously disregards a substantial and unjustifiable risk that the result will occur or that the circumstance exists. The risk must be of such a nature and degree that disregard of it constitutes a gross deviation from the standard of conduct that a reasonable person would observe in the situation. The concern I have, if you change it to knowingly, is people who want to remain ignorant of a fact. The circumstantial evidence around them tells them this person's a sex offender, they're supposed to be registered, they didn't register, but you don't take the extra step and ask them, or you don't check the sex offender registry. Well, I didn't know. This, if you're reckless and the state can prove you're reckless that the person does not comply, and then you choose not to report, that's what we have to prove.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Parks.
Representative Stoltz, do you have a follow-up?
No, I believe she answered most of it. I just don't imagine how this dynamic would work in a case where somebody has entered a family situation, and that's the one that just comes to mind. If am I on the right track here?
Representative Stoltz, through the chair, yes. I mean, it's one of the, ignorance can be bliss, and I think the concern is people will just choose not to confirm their suspicions because they don't want to have to turn someone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
If I may, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and maybe a little bit of latitude to go to what might be an amendment to the amendment.
Okay.
I think we've had a very good defense of the use of the word reckless here. I think that was pretty well explained to my satisfaction. But there's the conjunctive and the second part. And in this case, the and the second part knowingly fails to report the location. I guess as I've read through this, and again, with my humble apologies as a layman lacking any legal training, I don't see anything in here that says that the person has to know where the person is, but you fail to report, somehow we can be charged if we knowingly don't report. We're imposing a duty on someone who may not know even where the person is to report. They can be reckless, and I can be recklessly disregarding those facts. I can accept that part of the argument. But then I know that I didn't call up and turn them in. I know I didn't turn them in because I don't know where the perpetrator is. It seems to me we're creating a very dangerous jeopardy situation here, and kind of the proving of the negative. And I'm wondering how the sponsors of the bill carriers might view that issue.
Representative Newman.
To the chair, Representative Walker. I think it's a real policy call on this one myself when I look at this amendment. Are you reckless if you know that somebody is involved with some incest with their children? Or are you, I think that would probably be one of the common types of situation where maybe somebody might know of a sexual molester and where that's happening, where they don't want to bring it out and, air the family's dirty laundry in public, that type of an instance. I'm trying to think of other instances where you might know somebody who is a sexual molester who has done this and you purposely don't talk about it. Maybe if you were drinking or under the influence of some type of a narcotic and you watched a rape or an incest a violation occur and you didn't report that. Just to how guilty are you on that, and I'm not quite sure where we would go on that, but I mean, I'm trying to cover as many bases as I can, my mind goes back to more of the incest and family members. I'm probably the more typical situation where people know what's going on and they're afraid to go out there and talk about it. And who's the end result? Who's the real victim on this? Those people that are being molested, the child at the end. Now, how much responsibility do we have to society is ourselves, you know, to your brother on the street. If you know that somebody is creating sexual crimes against other persons, they're not trying to deal with this. Where does it stop? And where does it stop? You know, what, where do we draw the line in the sand as to where we're willing to stand up and say, as a society, you know, we need to start maybe having a little more latitude or aptitude of taking responsibility of what we recognize in society and helping to protect each other's needs.
If I might, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Gretchen Hawker.
If I might, before we go forward.
Okay, Gretchen Hawker.
The rebuttal argument I just heard certainly has validity because of, but I also believe that in, you know, our construction of statute, we have an absolute obligation to protect the innocent as well as provide the vehicle to prosecute the guilty. I'm a little afraid in this particular statute as prepared, we are setting up a statute that prosecutes the innocent, and I don't think that's appropriate.
Senator Gale.
Through the chair, Representative Cocker, I think your observation is a good one, to be honest with you, and I can tell you the intent, and maybe the language doesn't go the intent, and I'll be honest with you about that. The intent is that, you bring up an interesting case. I know someone hasn't registered, but I don't know their location. I might have known the last time I've seen them, and I would think that that would actually fall under location. Know someone's on the street that's staying with a family friend. I know that they're not registered. I can call in and say, this is the last time I saw them. I kind of see that as location. Some alternative wording would be fails to report the sex offender. And if fails to report the sex offender, we do think there's an obligation to report location. So you could go fails to report the sex offender or location. No, I'm more than willing. Mr. Chair, I'm not sure how you do amendments in this committee to work on an amendment that gets to the actual intent without prosecuting folks. It wasn't Senator Bunny nor my intent to have it including the bill written.
If I might, Mr. Chair,
go ahead,
and I sincerely appreciate the sponsor's understanding of the concern. Again, that's all evidence of good process here. If the chair's intention was to move the bill out today, which actually I would love to see done, we could take care of this between now and the time we got to amendment number 10. However, if the chair was not intending to move the bill today, we would have a chance to return if you'd allow us to revisit this with an amendment, subsequent amendment.
I think, yeah, if the sponsor of the amendment
yes.
Would withdraw.
Yes.
Amendment 7.
Thank you. No, I absolutely
will
withdraw the amendment.
Okay. And what we'll do, excuse me, we'll hold this bill over so that we have an opportunity then to adjust the fiscal notes based on the amendments that we've had. Then hopefully the next time we hear this bill will be the last time. We'll have current fiscal notes and we'll take up the Amendment 7 at that time.
That would be great. Thank
okay.
You.
So if the committee has no objections, we'll withdraw Amendment 7 and go on to Amendment 8.
Mr. Chairman, rather than bringing the other amendments, if we're going to hold the bill over, I'd like the opportunity just to talk to the sponsor briefly about them. I don't want to waste the committee's time.
Okay.
Thank you. Very
good. So let's withdraw 7 through 10 at this time, and we will let you make those amendments when we revisit this bill. Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, very good. So I think that's going to conclude this bill. We won't take this back up, like I said, after we've had the time to work with all three sponsors on the amendments. We'll get new fiscal notes and take the bill up at that time. Thank you again for coming back. But we'll deal with this bill one of these days here. It's a good bill. We all want to see it passed, but we want to have the best possible product that we can. So thank you again. With that, let's move on then to House Bill 408. If sponsors here, yes, I see Ms. Moss.
Done for the day.
If we could, let's just take a brief Eddie's here for just a second. Char, did you have everything you needed from that last
scene? Yeah.
And we do have the sponsor here, Miss Moss, staff for Representative Cogna, and also,
are you Tim?
Okay, well, I'll let you introduce yourself. Go ahead, Miss Moss.
I'm sorry,
Miss Moss. We need a motion to get the CS in front of us. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, I'll make a motion to adopt a blank committee substitute version 24-GH2021/Y. Michelle, 304 of 06 is the working document before the committee.
Okay. Any objections? Not that the CS is before us. Okay. Ms. Moss, sorry.
Yes, Mr. Chair. This bill is sponsored by the governor. And what we've done with this bill is, I think we learned a great lesson last year with House Bill 53 and combining efforts of the administration and different legislators into one bill and moving it as one vehicle, which we will entitle this the Family Rights Act of 2006. It has legislation in it that was proposed by Representative Chenault, Representative Coghill, the governor, and there's a few provisions in here that OCS themselves have requested be placed into the legislation. Just to let you know what Representative Coghill's concerns were in Section 5 of the CS, OCS found itself in a situation in the last year where the way the law was written under House Bill 53, they could only discuss the report of harm that involved a condition of disclosing information such as a death, something that resulted in a death, which did happen last fall. And OCS, it was difficult for them to deal with this case because the Attorney General's office said you can only discuss the last report of harm that resulted in the death. So this clarifies that they can talk about any report of harm once one of the conditions have been met, and they can talk about any child within number 6. And then the second concern of Representative Caldwell's is Section 7. And this actually came from a real experience that happened in Representative Caldwell's district. Two teenage children were placed in a foster home. They were given the status of legal guardians, and they went back and collected the children's back permanent fund dividends. The placement didn't work. The children were placed in another foster home, but the dividends were gone. This says that even if a child is placed with a legal guardian, once they've been in OCS's custody, the only way that those dividends can be acquired is when the child turns 18. The child will have 1 year to apply for those dividends and collect them themselves. So with that, I'll let Tammy explain to you. And also, in Section 4, Representative Chenault, Section 4 of Representative Chenault's legislation, I believe it was 327, it says that when a public official does request information, the department has 5 working days to disclose the information. And with that, I'll turn you over to Tammy Sandoval, who I must tell you, Representative Coghill and I are very pleased with. And we've made a commitment not to make any drastic legislation dealing with OCS and give her a chance to straighten her department up. And I think so far she's done an excellent job.
All right. Ms. Sandoval, good job. For the record.
Wow.
Yeah.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Tammy Sandoval. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Health and Social Services, Office of Children's Services. The original intent of House Bill 408 was to define federal law. The Keeping Children and Families Safe Act of 2003 amended the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act, or otherwise known as CAPTA, and a new federal requirement was enacted for those states receiving CAPTA funds. So House Bill 408 amended the definition of child abuse or neglect to include a condition determined at delivery by a health care provider that a child has been adversely affected by or is withdrawing from exposure to a controlled substance or alcohol. So basically that's about mandatory reporting by health care providers who believe that a child is affected or withdrawing from substance abuse or alcohol. The sections 1, 2, and 3 of this bill related to reasonable efforts and involuntary termination of parental rights are being amended to require the court to find clear, convincing evidence rather than a preponderance of evidence that the department has made reasonable efforts prior to terminating parental rights. And online is Jan Rutherdale, Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law, if there's any questions or we need to go into more detail about that. Section 4 of House Bill 408 is related to the Department of Health and Social Services and the administration's disclosure to certain public officials and their employees, which Reneva discussed that we will be responsible to get back to those folks requiring or desiring information from us within 5 working days. Sections 5 and 6 of this bill is related to disclosure of agency records, as Renee said, is being amended to comply with the intent of House Bill 53 as it relates to the department disclosing information to the public about high-profile child protection cases. Since the passage of House Bill 53, unfortunately, we've had the opportunity to have to experience how House Bill 53 works with regard to high-profile cases, and we believe that this new language will better apply to what was the intent. We believe that the current language prohibits us from responding in as a transparent and accountable manner as was originally intended by the governor and the legislature. Section 7, as Ms. Moss indicated, is proposed to be added to Title 47, relates to the permanent fund dividend. This new section would change the condition under which the Office of Children's Services could release a child's PFD trust account monies, and that is in short the department's offer for this bill.
Okay, very good. Any questions?
First thing to do.
Oh,
sorry. Ladies first.
Thanks. I do have a question for Ms. Rutherdale, I think, if she's online.
But that's correct.
Thanks. The question is right up front, and it's about changing the standard to clear and convincing instead of now, which is probably the current preponderance of the evidence.
And what's worrying me, in light of especially sort of our discussion on the bill we just had in front of us, is right now, if the court finds by a preponderance of the evidence, so a lower standard, it's like 51% more, they can pull the children out if they have information about sexual abuse, torture, chronic mental injury, chronic physical harm. It's really a serious thing. So I'm just wondering how the Department of Law feels about raising that standard.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Curtula, this is Jan Rutherdale from the Department of Law. And I think you have to remember that this case involves, these amendments involve the termination statute only. It seems like you're talking about the initial removal, which would come under temporary custody and then eventually adjudication.
Thank you you're right. Thank you. That's okay. What was worrying me. So the Department of Law is okay with raising this standard?
Yes. In fact, we are the ones that realize the current problem because there is a legitimate constitutional argument that this standard of proof, preponderance of the evidence, would be too low, and so we're trying to get a legislative fix before a court challenge.
Thank you very much. That clears it up for me. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Representative
Chenault. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just looking at the fiscal note, and it's an indeterminate fiscal note. If this legislation passes, then you're saying that OCS would probably be affected by requiring to track child 30 years of up till they're 18 in order to release monies held in guardianship or prior to guardianship. You know how many kids you do that for now versus what you think you might in the future?
Representative Chenault, that fiscal note was created yesterday when there was some clarity still needed on what was intended with the PFD. We met with Representative Kotko's office and OPA and determined that what we feared was not the intent, and so the fiscal note would be zero. And just so that you're wondering, we have to date 17 children who are in guardianship placements from this fiscal year, in this fiscal year. So only 17 children in this fiscal year thus far.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you, Representative Schultz. Okay, any other questions for Ms. Voss? Senator Deputy. Well, that's great coming from the majority leader's office. Glowing remarks. Representative Petula.
I don't know if we have the right people to respond. I had a question about the section that added alcohol into the definition of child abuse and neglect. Should I ask that now or should I wait for the witnesses?
I don't believe we have any other.
But my concern about the section then on page 7 and then section 8 is how, what kind, when the standard is just adversely affected by alcohol, and there's a determination of delivery, what I don't know is how much of an effect would you have from alcohol to really be able to tell the delivery that there was an impact? And what I'm getting to is the pregnant woman who may have had a couple of drinks before she knew she was pregnant. And maybe the reality is that there isn't, you know, that kind of a thing wouldn't be so adverse that you would notice anything in delivery. I just don't know the reality of that. But I am concerned that someone who's had a couple drinks before they even knew that they were pregnant, I don't believe that they should be included in this.
We do have the, Jen Rutherdale's online. Did that question?
She might, although she's a lawyer, not a doctor.
I can take a stab at it if
sure.
You want. Okay, through the chair, Representative Curtula, you know, again, I'm a lawyer and not a physician or anything, but my understanding of the fetal alcohol spectrum disorder is that you it's only the children that are born at birth with very obvious signs of alcohol abuse. Facial features. They can, by taking measurements between the widespread eyes, and there's other, you know, something about the nose and the cleft palate, or, you know, the palate or something. There are ways you can tell, but in those cases, that we're not talking about two drinks before they know they're pregnant. I mean, that those are I don't know the statistics, but that's a very minor percentage of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder cases. In those, you would have to have a lot of alcohol to cause those kind of birth defects. The other effects of alcohol are not apparent until even the child reaches school age. I mean, sometimes, you know, it comes across in behavior, cause and effect kind of judgment, you know, poor judgment, that sort of thing.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Did you want to add anything?
No, if there's any questions, I can, but I won't take the committee's time.
Okay. Very good. Any other questions for the Parker Law or Ms. Sandoval or Ms. Moss? Seeing none, then I have no one signed up to testify. Is that correct? Okay. Is there anybody here in the audience who wanted to testify? Okay. See no one. Okay, why don't you stay, Ms. Sandoval? Let's look at the. I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony. So, if someone wants to testify, we'll bring the bill back to force with the fiscal notes. Now, the fiscal notes was indeterminate. You want to explain that?
Sure. That Representative Meyer, that's what I addressed from Representative Chenault's question. It was indeterminate because we needed to have a meeting with Representative Cockrell's office, but it would be a zero fiscal note.
Okay.
Because we cleared up that confusion that we had.
Okay, so my question would you be comfortable with us making that a zero fiscal
note? Yes.
Okay, very good.
Mr. Chairman, do you want me to clarify what the misunderstanding was?
Sure.
We were concerned that maybe the way it was written, OCS would be required to apply for dividends for children who were no longer in their custody, but they were placed with a legal guardian. The way it is written, they apply for dividends only while the child is in the custody of OCS. Once the child is out of the custody of OCS and in the custody of a legal guardian, then either the dividend would not be applied for or the legal guardian could go to court and get permission to apply for.
Okay, very good.
So it's out of OCS at times.
Very good. President Chenault, did you want to move to?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would make a motion that we zero out the indeterminate fiscal note dated 07 of 06 for the title relating to child in need of aid proceedings, Department of Effectiveness, Health and Social Services.
Okay. Any objections? Seeing none, then the fiscal note will reflect the zero fiscal note. Okay. There's no other amendments, questions? I'll take a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to make one comment. I would also like to thank Tammy for her work that she's probably done with my office. My office is probably one that seems like we get a lot of these type cases. And we're always looking for ways to improve the system, and I think that with this we have. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would make a motion that we move CS for House Bill 408 out of committee with individual recommendations and zero attached fiscal notes.
Okay. Any objections? See none. Bill passed out of committee. Thank you both for joining us today. Okay. The last bill for this afternoon is House Bill 485.
Actually, the timing of this announcement may not be good, but I want to welcome welcome all of you to have a donut back there. We have Faith Putman to thank that, and his cell phone, I guess. So appreciate that, Mr. Putman.
Yes, sir. Make a quick comment. That's why you never give your number to legislators.
Yeah, we have a tendency to call you when
you least expect it.
Or at least when we're hungry. Okay, so this is Janet Clark. Are you the one presenting this for the governor, or Virginia Smiley? I've got several names here.
Oh.
Yeah, this is House Bill 485 that doesn't look to be in CS, so okay. So we, okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Janet Clark of the Department of Public Services, and with me is Virginia Smiley, the director of Pioneer Homes. With the Department of Health and Social Services, and we'd like to really support for House Bill 485. This afternoon, what I'd like to do is have Ms. Smiley tell you a little bit about the situation that the Pioneer Homes family settles in about a year ago, and then we'll go over the other aspects of the bill.
For the record, I'm Virginia Smiley, Director of the Division of Pioneer Homes and Department of Health and Social Services. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to take just a moment to put the current issues with the pharmacist salaries in context and maybe just a brief overview of the pharmacy and pharmacist duties that we have. The six Pioneer Homes located in Ketchikan, Sitka, Juneau, Anchorage, Homer, and Fairbanks all rely on receiving their medications for their residents from the division's central pharmacy located in the Anchorage Pioneer Home. Per state and federal law, the pharmacy must be under the oversight of licensed pharmacists. We can and do use pharmacy interns and pharmacy assistants, but three pharmacists are necessary to supervise staff, dispense medications, comply with Medicare Part D and Medicaid documentation, and provide clinical consultation to physicians, residents, families, and staff. In the quarter ending December 31st, 2005, the pharmacy packaged and dispensed, this is a big number, 353,821 individual doses of medications. Dispensing that volume of medications requires a full staff present and working. The problem is that we have almost a full year's history in first losing our pharmacists to jobs that pay higher wages and then not being able to attract new pharmacists to apply for the vacant positions. The federal government is paying wages that are competitive with the private sector, and they offer bonuses and forgiveness of student loans, and we do not. Nationally, the same is true in the private sector, as shown by lucrative offers being made to pharmacists in recruitment letters and advertising in national publications. For 8 months of last year, we had a single pharmacist on our payroll. It was necessary for us to sign contracts with two temp agencies, and we were able to fill many, but not all, of those vacant shifts. We paid the contract agencies $70 an hour for their pharmacists. At that time, we paid our own pharmacists $33 an hour. At this critical point, we finally placed the pharmacist PCN into a temporary higher-paying category in order to recruit and hire more competitively. However, the Division of Personnel advised us that we need to seek a more permanent solution, and that's why we're here today. The problem is that under the current wage scale for permanent pharmacist positions in the state system, we're not competitive with other employers. We're asking to have the pharmacists move into the exempt service with other professional classifications, as it will provide us with the flexibility to be competitive in the market.
Mr. Chairman, to follow up, House Bill 45 has two sections. The first section is to move pharmacists into the exempt service. We have eight positions in the Department of Health and Social Services that are pharmacy positions, three in the Pioneer Home, two in API, two in Medicaid, managing our $100 million pharmacy costs, and then one in epidemiology and public health. People in these positions are required to either provide direct dispensing services or high-level consultation services. that's very critical to our clients. ERISA rates the state if we're not able to have pharmacist positions filled in these very small but critical areas. And we need to be able to compete in the marketplace to fill our pharmacist positions. As Ms. Smiley mentioned, under the state classified salary scale, pharmacists are paid approximately $33 an hour. In the private sector, we're seeing anywhere from $55 to $65 an hour, and as noted, our contract, we had to pay a $70 an hour fee for temporary pharmacists. We believe that with the required medical credentials for licensed pharmacists, that it's clear to us that the pharmacist category now more correctly belongs in the exempt category, as are psychiatrists, physicians, the medical examiner, and the deputy medical examiner. So we urge your support of House Bill 485.
Okay, very good. Now, did corrections and revenue also want to introduce their part of the bill? Okay. So any questions then for folks here in front of us at this time? Okay. Seeing none, we'll let the corrections guys come up. Corrections and revenue?
For the record, my name is Laura Lincoln, and I'm with the Department of Corrections. We basically mirror the same concerns that the Department of Health and Social Services has. We have one pharmacist, and we have had the same difficulties in recruiting and retaining a pharmacist position. And this legislation has helped us tremendously in retaining and hiring pharmacists.
Very good. Okay, let me ask you one question. Pharmacists, what their education requirement is?
I believe they're the same. They have to be licensed. The education requirements and the licensing requirements would be the same.
But we're typically talking about people here with probably 5 or 6 years of college?
Yes.
Almost the same as a doctor, maybe not quite as much.
Close.
Yeah, okay, very good. All right, thank you very much. Almost as much as a CPA, right?
I'm going to let your last conclusion lie, sir.
Yeah, I don't think it's quite as much as a doctor. But, let's see, corrections. Did you guys? Revenue.
These are the accountants.
Yeah, okay.
For the record, my name is Jerry Brown. I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Revenue. And working as Robin Wilson, who is the Director of the Tax Division of the Department of Revenue. The second part of this bill moves corporate income tax forensic auditors into the exempt service. And I'll let Robin Wilson talk about why.
Ms. Wilson?
Thank you. For the record, my name is Robin Wilson. I'm the Director of the Tax Division for the Department of Revenue. I'd like to start and just spend a minute or two explaining what auditors do, because I think it's pretty clear what pharmacists do. What we do in the income tax arena is we try to figure out how much of a group of companies' income is taxable to Alaska. Now, if you can imagine all of the multi-state companies that do business here, the national banks, national retail chains, multi-state, in fact, multinational oil companies, then you can begin to imagine who our taxpayers are. We do not spend a lot of time on those corporations that only do business within the state, but we concentrate our efforts on those that do business in multiple jurisdictions. And so the sort of starting point for that is their federal income. But also, particularly with the oil companies, we're looking at a worldwide set of books. And so at that point, then we look at their worldwide income and try to figure out what piece is taxable by Alaska. And that's done on a formalistic basis based on
property sales and in the case of oil companies, extraction. So, for example, how much property is in the state compared to everywhere else, and how much sales in the state, and so on. And while that may appear to be easy, if you can imagine a building sitting here, that's pretty easy to value. But if you think about the tankers that move crude oil down to the Lower 48 and so on, how do you value those tankers and how do you find where they are? So those are some of the complexities that go into it. Just to get a little bit of sort of history, I was hired with the division about 11 years ago as an auditor. And at that time, we had 10 auditors. And our market for new employees, new auditors, was typically from big public accounting firms. And at the time, maybe it was the big six or the big eight, I can't remember exactly. But there was that market available. The other place that we got auditors was from the Internal Revenue Service. So a number of our more experienced auditors came from that arena. At the time, public accounting did their business in a different way than they do now. They typically made their money by hiring people fresh out of school and then working 60, 70, 80 hours a week. And some of us got tired of doing that. So that's kind of how the firms made their money, and that's how we got our experience. And at the same time, the state paid an okay amount compared to the federal government. Not great, but it was okay, all things considered. Since that time, several things have changed. One is that the big public accounting firms have condensed, so we now have, I don't know, maybe the big four, and really in Anchorage, I think we're down to one of those firms. So our supply has dried up to an extent. The second thing that's happened is they've changed their way of doing business. So they don't hire people out of college and work them to death quite as much as they used to. They usually have, in the past several years, made their money typically selling tax structured transactions or tax shelters, if you will. And I will mention that a little later. And I think the third thing that's happened is probably you're all aware of the Enron mess from 2001 and new accounting rules that have come up with the SEC since then. And what that means is accountants and auditors are absolutely at a premium in the workforce marketplace. And so at the same time, then wages have gone up and up in the private sector, and the state of Alaska salaries have maintained relatively flat progression. At the same time, the wages for the federal government have gone up as well. So what we have found ourselves over this last 10-year, 11-year period is we have gone down from 10 auditors to 2. Now, the last 2 that were lost, one of them was myself, and that was a couple of months ago, and another auditor was promoted to an appeals position. But you can see that auditing all of the multinational corporations and do business in the state, having 2 people do that is pretty much undoable. So that's sort of the crunch in which we have found ourselves. We have in that time tried several different ways of recruiting people. We've tried, I believe, 7 different recruitments for experienced auditors. Our last successful recruitment for an experienced person was in 1998. We have since thought, well, why don't we try recruiting, say, at the college level and instead of putting in a training plan. And so then, for example, we've gone to University of Alaska in Fairbanks to visit with them. And haven't got a lot of bites in that area. But more importantly, at this point, we do not have the experience base to train if we did hire 5 or 6 new college graduates. So we are sort of at a crisis point with our experienced income tax auditor. And that is why, after having also done a classification study that was based on internal alignment, we've gone through some various steps. We've recruited outside. We've kind of tried everything that we have
thought of to try. And clearly salary is the problem. So with this bill, we are proposing establishing three exempt positions to be paid at market rate, with the hopes that we can attract experienced people that can hit the ground running.
Okay, very good. So do you think if we change this statute, we'll increase exploration and production of oil? Oh, that's wrong. I'm so used to seeing you here in front of talking to us about PPT, so it's hard to see you in this venue without talking about oil taxes.
Well, that's true, and at the same time, if I might just piggyback on that, one of the questions in one of the hearings was, are you going to find auditors to do this new production tax?
Right. I do remember that, yes. So what is, if I can just follow up on a previous question, what is the education requirement for most of your auditors? Are they CPAs? Or?
We require a bachelor's degree in business with a certain number of hours of accounting. The education requirements envisioned for these exempt positions would include, again, a bachelor's or a master's or a certified public accountant certificate.
Would you like to hire Richardson Hawker?
Absolutely.
We're ready to get rid of her. No, sorry.
That's terrible. She's going to pay me much better than I'm getting for this job.
That's not saying much.
It's not saying.
Yes. Richardson Jewell.
What's the difference in when someone is in exempt status? Is that more of an administrative? How is that?
To the chair, Representative Jewell, an exempt position is not covered under the personnel rules that are adopted by the Department of Administration and the Personnel Board, and they are not subject to the pay and salary, or the salary and schedule that other employees are, so we can pay them in a different way than current salary schedule. And I believe Neil Cosgrove, who's the director of the division of personnel, is in the room and could answer further questions on that.
Sure.
Are
exempt generally appointed positions, i.e., are those government appointments, governor appointments?
Through the chair, Representative Jewell, we have in the Department of Revenue a number of exempt investment officers, and when those are hired, it's not a political hire, it's a professional hire. We're looking at people who have the experience and ability to manage maybe billions of dollars. That's certainly not a political question, but the salary is approved, and the hire and salary package is approved by the government office.
Anything else? Okay, Rips and Stoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just trying to grasp why the exempt. Does it have anything to do with how fast the process works? Is that one of the motivators? If you have is there something about the classified system or whatever the opposite of the next step below the non-exempt is that gives you problems? I'm trying to get a hold on the salary part makes sense, but the exempt part is where.
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz. The issue is salary primarily in this case. We certainly have no problems working through the classified service in terms of hiring and promoting people, but we can't pay beyond the salary schedule. And if it's a classified as a range 22 position, we can only pay up to a range 22 under normal conditions, RG, depending on which union they're in, and so we can't move to a salary where an experienced CPA probably is commanding a salary well over $100,000. So,
sure, and sounded like a pretty bleak picture on these financial, even on the entry level. It almost sounded like they're better off going to a boiler room cold calling widows than selling financial plans and coming to work for the state. Or, I mean, is that a no offense to the profession?
Our economic research group did a little bit of a salary survey, and it really was focused on our auditor three. not the upper end of the experience, but the trees, and found that there was clearly a salary disparity, but it was a bigger disparity at more experienced levels, whereas at the auditor ones and twos, there was a salary disparity, but it wasn't nearly as large. It's more in the range of 5,000 to 7,000, which is not that much. But clearly, the upper end is where the problem is, and that's what we're trying to address. At the same time, I understand Department of Administration is working, and I'm sure that Neil will expand on that, but they're working on a market-based pay study, but the idea is that perhaps auditors could move one or two ranges up, depending on market. But clearly, even that won't, if you move two ranges up from a range 22, you're clearly not within market. And that's why we feel it's necessary to move to an exempt category for these particular experience and
complaints. Anything else? Okay, Representative Couture.
Well, with the exempt employees, though, it's much easier to fire them. I mean, I remember the Department of Law, every single employee, all the attorneys had to turn in letters of resignation. And with the coming oil taxes, and that gives me some pause, why not just negotiate and get the higher salaries in the collective bargaining system rather than open up the employees for that kind of possible political impact?
Through the chair, Representative Petula, we have approached every angle we thought internally that would work, and there may be some possibility of negotiating a higher salary within the classified service, and that is something we would have to talk to Director of Labor Relations about. One thing that you would have to remember, if we could do that, the terms of that negotiation then would become the terms of the negotiated labor agreement, which we would then have to present to the legislature for your approval. And it would appear to me that that would be a very inefficient way to hire someone.
No, I'm not sure it might not be worth it, given the jobs these people are going to have and the kind of pressure they might be brought under. That's all. Thanks.
Okay. Representative Cook?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Isn't it quite normal that these types of positions in the private sector are exempt positions, whether it's the pharmacy professional or the accounting CPA type professional? Are those typically exempt in the private sector?
Well, through the chair, Representative Kelly, I would guess that the private sector, what you would call a professional job or an exempt job, would be quite different than what we have in the public sector. So I don't know that there's a comparison, but they're professional. Certainly they would be an at-will employee in any event, and you're looking at performance. I can't imagine a situation in which a person in a professional level job in the Department of Revenue would be fired for political reasons or would fear for being fired for political reasons when we have a very shortage of CPAs and when that would be a public event.
To that point, sir.
Sure, go ahead.
My first experience in this body 4 years ago, there was tremendous pressure brought upon me to reach very deep into the various departments and fire people for political reasons. So I just can't agree with you on that one.
Okay. All right. Any other questions for these folks? Okay. Let's go on then. We do have Marla Cosgrove, but it says she's online for questions.
I'm available.
Oh, there you are. Okay. You're not online, you're here. Did you want to testify or just?
I don't have any testimonies.
Okay. All right. Okay, let's just stay put. Okay, let's go on then. Jim Duncan. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much for allowing me to testify. My name is Jim Duncan. I'm the business manager for the Alaska State Employees Association. We're the union that represents some of the pharmacists and all the auditors who would be in this legislation. I'll try to make my testimony short. There are several points that I think that Mr. Chairman, I hope that you would consider as you're looking at this legislation. Let me say I agree that pharmacists and auditors are hard recruited, are not competitive, and they do need a higher salary. I have no dispute with the Department of Health and Social Services about that. That is, those are only hard to fill positions. However, moving to exempt service, as in House Bill 485, is not the way to solve that problem and address the real core of the issue. It's only a convenient and easy approach to management. It doesn't really solve the problem, because not only do you have hard-to-fill pharmacists and auditors, but also engineers and biologists, and go down the list. The whole range of those positions are difficult to fill, so this is not the solution. Let me mention several things. First of all, the merit system of employment. And, Mr. Chairman, as you're aware, Article 12, Section 6 of the Constitution does establish a merit system of employment. And that was, if you go back and read the minutes of the Constitutional Convention when they brought together the Constitution, this area was debated hot and heavily by the delegates. And it does say that there shall be a merit system. There was debate as to whether it should be shall or may. And actually, an amendment was made to make it may, and it failed overwhelmingly. So the constitutional, the founding fathers decided that this state shall have a merit system of employment. And the idea was that those who are not in the merit system, or the merit system would be for those professionals who have a background, education, competency, and they would progress through the ranks based upon that. Those in exempt service would be the policymakers, the commissioners, and those who are directly appointed by the governor. Since that time, we have changed that definition a little bit. And this bill is in danger of changing it even more by really bringing this shall to a may and leaving it up to the legislature to decide when there will be or when there will not be a merit system of employment. The reason given here today was strictly on pay, not on policy. They couldn't afford to pay the folks what they need to pay them in the classified system and under collective bargaining agreements. I'm going to talk about that in just a little bit. But that is not the reason for folks being in the exempt service. It's the policymakers who are to be in the exempt service. Let me just say that when you do move to exempt service, you are subject to political pressure. I don't know if there would be any political pressure in the parties. There may or may not be. I don't know why there would be. But just think about a corporate revenue tax auditor who is very aggressively pursuing a tax case against one of the multi-state or multinational corporations. And that corporation would like them to slow down just a little bit. If they're in exempt service, they have the ability to bring that pressure, to slow them down, to back them off, maybe get them heading in a different direction. And as you're looking at changing the corporate tax structure in the state, I'm not sure that at the same time you're doing that, you want to move those folks who are going to get sharp and forcing collecting that tax and offering those firms to exempt service where they could be subject to political pressure. I'll say that would happen, but sure, the possibility. And of course, we saw that in the DNR just several months ago, so we do know that in the exempt service, changes can be made, and they can be made very rapidly. Secondly, the classified system is not the problem here. And we've heard discussions that we can't do it under a classified system. The classified system is not the problem. The pay plan within that classified system is the problem. We do have, under our collective bargaining agreement, a pay plan that goes up to range 27. For non-covered, before the exempt, where these folks should be moved, it goes to range 30. But let me say that pay plan is meant to change. It's a mandatory subject to bargaining. The Alaska Supreme Court has determined in a court case that pay plans are mandatory subjects to bargaining. The administration could very well come back to my union and say, we need to change the pay plan because we can't pay folks well enough. They did not do that 2 years ago when they were at the table. But they could do that. And because that's the way it should happen, I am preparing, meant to have it to the administration already, but it was out of town over the past few days and didn't get to it. A letter to the director, to the commission administration, requesting that we open negotiations to put together a pay plan to meet these needs. I'm not talking about increasing pay for those who are currently covered by our collective bargaining schedule, range 20s and 18s and 16s, they have the same pay, but only adding those ranges, 28, 29, and 30, in our pay plan. And that could be done quickly, it could be done efficiently, and it would help resolve this problem. And my position is that if you can afford to pay someone at range 29 or 30 in the exempt service, then you can afford to pay them that same salary in the classified service. There is no increased cost. of being in the classified service. So I will be giving those to the state soon, that we're prepared to go back and negotiate a pay plan. We're not looking for pay increases. That will come when we negotiate a contract in a year and a half from now, that we're looking to put a pay plan together that will address this need. Third, there's the argument that the classification system would not allow the movement, even if we did have a pay plan that goes to range 30. Well, I'm not quite sure that's the case, and I would ask you to ask the Department Administration to go back and look at that. They did do studies based on internal alignment. Standard operating procedures of the Division of Personnel allows internal and slash or external comparisons, so they can compare to the market. There have been market-based studies in the past with nurses and others, and I believe they can do it in this case also. They will also say, well, we've got to maintain internal alignment with job class families. And my answer to that would be, well, look at your job class families. Maybe they're not appropriate. For example, right now, they are comparing the revenue auditors for, and these new risk auditors would be very the same, I believe, to accountants, internal auditors, and program managers. I have great respect for folks who fill those positions, but I don't think a program budget analyst or even an accountant or internal auditor performs the same functions that these forensic tax auditors are expected to perform when it comes to auditing multi-state, multinational corporations, protecting the revenues of this state and collecting the revenues of this state. So I think it's quite possible that the job classes that they're comparing revenue auditors to is inappropriate. And they should split those out and compare them to a separate job class and perhaps create a job class family of their own. This is a piecemeal approach, and it's an approach which I believe will not serve this state well. It will continue the same problems we have. There will be continuous problems to recruit, will pay, and continue to see the erosion of the merit system. Mr. Chairman, just quickly, let me mention both classes that are being proposed here, both jobs that are being proposed here very specifically. First, on the pharmacist. We do represent some of those pharmacists, and I do have a couple concerns. One is, and I did mention the testimony when I testified before the State Affairs Committee, I don't know the answer to this question, but I'd ask the committee to look for it. There are federal regulations that require that individuals who are funded by federal grants be in a merit system. The pharmacist positions are federally funded to some extent, and I believe it's to a level of about 50%. The question that I think the finance committee should explore is, will we lose that federal funding? What is the true cost? As I said, I don't know the answer, but I reference you to Federal Regulation 900.601, where it does talk about that for certain federal grant programs require the condition of eligibility that state and local agencies to receive grants established merit personnel systems for the personnel engaged in administering those programs. Moody Health and Social Services knows this answer. I did hear them say, well, the commissioner doesn't get federal funding. I understand that. But I'm talking about the pharmacists who may be here. And I'm not saying I'm correct on this, but I think it's worth looking at. Secondly, just for your consideration, these pharmacists are positions that are established already. They are filled by the program of field positions. And there is a provision in our state constitution, Article 1, Section 15, that says you cannot compare a contract by passing a statute. Those pharmacists are covered by our current collective bargaining agreement. The agreement we negotiated effective July 1st, 2004. And without reading it, Article 1.01 talks about that all the positions that are in general government deal positions will be covered by this contract as far as their wages, conditions, working conditions, et cetera, go. And all positions that are created that have been designated as these new positions by the Alaska Labor Relations Agency. However, has not changed the designation of pharmacists from GGU to exempt. This statute would violate our contract provision. It does impair a contract. Our position very strongly is you cannot move positions out from under our contract until the expiration of the agreement, which doesn't expire until June 30th of 07, and may very well be excluded at that point. Bringing that just to your attention, because I think it is a serious problem. We as a union don't like to get into these types of tug of war, but we will. And if this should happen, we would have to take appropriate steps under that contract to enforce the contract and to ensure that those positions did not be moved. Finally, Mr. Chairman, on the revenue auditors, I do believe that this is a process that is, the process that is used, is being used, is flawed. The bill seems to imply that a new class of physicians are being created, derivative forensic tax auditor. Mr. Chairman, I asked this question to stay fair, and I don't believe you've been presented with it yet. I don't know what the position description for a forensic tax auditor is, nor do I dare say to you. In fact, the testimony I heard before State Affairs was, well, we don't have a position description written. The way we want to work this is go out and find who we would like to hire, and then we'll write a position description that will match that individual. Mr. Chairman, that is not the way this process should work. If you look at the, I really believe that the forensic tax auditor is nothing more than the revenue auditor form, which is currently a position that is currently created. I have the job description of the revenue auditor 4 here. Those revenue auditor 4s, part of their description is to work with multiple and complex accounting methods and systems. Audit generates significant revenue from the central collection of additional taxes, apply a wide, diverse body of authorities dealing with apportionment issues, determine correct unitary group, determine correct apportionable income, apportionment factors. I think the legislation here says that's what the appropriate, what the forensic auditor is supposed to do, proportionate. I think that's the testimony I've heard. They also have to be aware of state statute, federal regulations, et cetera. So I believe, Mr. Chairman, that this new group of positions that are being created, the forensic tax auditors, are one and the same as the revenue corporate income tax auditor 4, as just an attempt to create a different title but have the same job duties moved over out of classified service into exempt service. The way this should work is they should come back with a new pay plan. We want to discuss that with us, put together a position description for a forensics auditor, run that through the Department of Administration to be placed on a pay plan, and then go back and do the hiring process. That has not been done. So, Mr. Chairman, in summary, I think it's a flawed process. It ignores the constitutional requirement of the merit principle. It violates provisions of our collective bargaining agreement, and I would dare say the collective bargaining agreement of other unions who may represent the pharmacists. It ignores the mandatory section of bargaining, that of bargaining a pay plan. And I believe very seriously puts corporate revenue auditors at will, if it does put corporate revenue auditors at will, subject to legal pressure from those very people there on it, puts at risk state's ability to protect revenues. And as you're considering a new revenue system, I find it very coincidental that while you're considering a new revenue system, at the same time a piece of legislation appears that would put those folks who are charged with enforcing and collecting those taxes, puts them in an admirable position where they are subject to legal pressure. Mr. Chairman, I believe this piece of legislation should not move in. Urge you to look at it very carefully.
Thank you, Mr. Duncan. Questions for Mr. Duncan? Representative Hawkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Duncan, have you or anyone who has also been aligned with your interests in this debate been engaged in any discussions of the issues you have brought before us with members of the administration in any capacity?
Mr. Chairman, no, we have not, Representative Hawker. And this will surprise me. I actually didn't. We just got introduced on February 15th, I think, so we were really caught off guard. We did not see this as an issue. We did not have time. We were not asked to discuss this. The administration did not come to us in advance and ask to discuss this with us and how we might address it. So we have not had that opportunity. But as I said, I am going to be sending a letter to the Department of Administration about the new program.
Quick follow-up.
Sure.
Do you believe there is room for productive and constructive discussions? Were you afforded that opportunity?
Yes, I do. In fact, it really should not be difficult to put a pay plan in place if we're not asking for more money in that pay plan. We're just asking to move just to put on 3 more ranges, extrapolating at the same level of pay that they have from a range plus 7 or 9. So it should be, I believe that's a process that can happen very quickly if you make sure we want to do that.
And emphasizing, this is not reopening the entire collective bargaining negotiation.
No, sir. My letter will make it clear to the administration that I'm interested in discussing a new pay plan. And as we discussed that, I'm not interested in discussing pay increases for any of our current members. I'm only interested in bringing our pay plan into a compliance where by adding wages 28, 29, 30 based on the wage scale we currently have.
Thank you, sir.
Okay,
Director
Kelly.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question, and I don't know of examples, but has this happened before? If so, recently, how many positions where a position has gone from covered service to the exempt? And can you give examples of it, or is this a brand new thing?
Well, I think if you look at the statute, and I was never in a copy with me, and I didn't, but there are a whole list of positions that have been added to the exempt service over the years. So this is not the first time the Virginia College has happened. However, the recent ones were not in the line agencies themselves. There were a couple of commissions where they moved into exempt service, like Mental Health Trust Authority, where they moved their employees into exempt service. But I think at that time, they all called the employees and then rehired them to the exempt service, but there is a list. I don't have that before me, and I can't recall how when the last one was. I would say, I think it's happening up now. We need to be very cautious, because clearly, if we're going to do it based just on the justification that we need to pay them more, as I said, there are a whole list of jobs where pay is not adequate. Biologists, engineers, we go down the list, and pretty quickly have a system that exempts service systems instead of classified services.
Just one quick follow-on, Mr. Chairman. Waves go through society and always have from time to time. You're short engineers and you're short architects, you're short a biologist, whatever. And those waves come and go. Is the system that you're proposing flexible enough to understand that something that can ratchet up can ratchet right back down?
Yes, I believe it is, Mr. Chairman. I mean, clearly, our goal with the union would never be to decrease our pay scale. We would never do that. Right? We're always going to want more pay, so we're always going to negotiate for more pay. But, for example, if there is a classification process that the Department of Administration does, if they look at classifications on an ongoing basis for individual positions and for classes of positions. If they should determine at some point, and there have been determinations, that certain positions should be classified down where they can be classified down.
Mr. Chairman, just one. As I understand it, there's a temporary in place for these. I just had a brief moment with Ms. Smiley yesterday. Okay, so is it possible that that's a way to do it that would make it to the next regular round of bargaining? I mean, has that come up? I'm not familiar with the issue at this point.
That could, I guess, continue on to the next round of bargaining. We're going back to table, we're supposed to go back to table in December of this year, depending on how, whether administration changes or not. We could go back sooner or later, but we're supposed to go back to table into this calendar year to begin negotiations again. So clearly, it probably could go on a temporary basis for that period of time. This piece of legislation, by the way, is not the quick fix. It's going to take effect in July of this year either. So I think before then, we could have a pay plan
and work with the
administration.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Kelly. Any other questions from Mr. Duncan? See none, thank you very much. I do think we need to have Ms. Cosgrove, is that correct?
Yes,
I actually, what I'd like to do is just hold this bill over, we'll bring it back up, and I'd like to have you come up and kind of explain the administration's perspective on what Mr. Duncan said. Also,
I would be happy to do that. Just so you know, I'm about to go into a series of very demanding meeting schedules related to the RFP for the human resource payroll system, in which I will not be flexible and I have to be present. So I'm happy to come and testify again, but my availability is going to be extremely truncated for the next 2 weeks.
Okay. Well, what we can do, I can go ahead and give you a few minutes to kind of give us your perspective on what Mr. Duncan said. I would like to see Mr. Duncan's letter that he's going to write to the administration, because I think that'll summarize his points, and then we can bring the bill back up that time. You may want to have somebody from your department here when we bring it up.
Yeah,
okay,
you.
Sure.
For the record, this is Neil Cosgrove. I'm the Director of the Division of Personnel.
for the Department of Administration. I wanted to address a couple of points that just came up because I think there's some accurate perceptions and some misconceptions, and I wanted to make sure that the committee has a full understanding of what happens. First of all, an exempt to, there are three types of employees in state service. There are classified, partially exempt, and exempt employees. And the shorthand of that is classified or fully subject to the merit system, and all of the personnel and pay rule provisions, including the classification of pay plans. Partially exempt are not subject to all of the rules, but they are subject to the classification of pay plan. And finally, exempt employees are subject neither to the classification plan nor the pay plan, but they may be in collective bargaining. And an example of that are the vessel employees of the Alaska Marine Highway System. So exempt does not necessarily mean exempt from collective bargaining. It simply means we don't have to consider them in the entirety of the classification plan. There is the accurate perception that a lot of exempt employees are at will. Not all of them, certainly, but some of them are. However, I would also like to point out that human resources, like any other area of life, has lots of laws and regulations that apply to it. And while there are clearly individuals who serve at the governor's pleasure, like commissioners who are exempt, and some other high-level policymakers, other positions that are in exempt service have a higher bar for dismissal from state service. And there are a number of employees in that long list that are in fact state employees, and they are treated fairly and equitably with all the management rights that and considerations that you would expect to find. So at will doesn't mean easily dismissed. And in fact, there's an emerging body of employment law that indicates that bar is rising higher and higher for at will employees as well, especially those that are not at the policy level. I'd like to just point out that wages for pharmacists and other medical professionals are extremely volatile right now. But Mr. Duncan does raise some good points about including and potentially in bargaining. If they're left in a classified service, they're subject to the classification and pay plans. And I can give you more information on that at a later time if you'd like. But I believe that the wages, the current market wages for pharmacists and those highest level of auditors, are well beyond what we can negotiate under our current classification plan, which relies on the concept of internal alignment. And even though we consider market-based pay in that, they still have to bear job classes and any job class families still have to bear some relationship to each other. If we were to take, for instance, the forensic auditors up to where they are in the market, it would mean that the internal auditor, revenue auditor type positions would also go up, and I would argue that that's not the best use of state resources. I'd also like to point out that it is true the state is considering a market-based pay plan. I've given some testimony on that, and I actually had a meeting with Anchorage on Friday to try to get the administrative process to the personnel board for that. But again, it is also still clued to internal alignment, and we can't just raise a whole job class family up because we have trouble at the very highest level. Mr. Duncan adequately pointed out we do have pay issues for a wide variety of job classes. I believe the market-based pay plan will address that. I believe the market-based pay plan will not address the issues that we have with the pharmacists and the corporate income tax auditors at the highest level. So I know you're under time constraint. I'll leave it at that, but I would like to reply in more detail when you meet again, because I think it's important that you understand the full picture and not the isolated slices that were presented here.
Okay, very good. And we will let you know when we do take this back up again, so either yourself or something.
I'll do my best to attend. I just wanted to let you know that it's a tight 2 weeks.
I understand. Okay, very good. Thank you. Okay, well, let's hold this bill for a few time being. We have several questions yet to be answered, some more research to be done. So with that, tomorrow we'll be meeting at our regular time, which is 1:30, and three bills currently scheduled: retirement system bonds, House Bill 278. Is that true?
That's a very good bill, sir.
That's a good bill. Okay. Senate Bill 172, having to do with initiative referendum ballot summaries, and Senate Bill 210, violation of alcoholic beverage laws. Okay. Is there there anything else coming for the committee? Not. Thank you. We're adjourned.